The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Megan Dom. Megan is the author of 5 books, including The Unspeakable and Other Subjects of Discussion, which won the 2015 Penn Center USA Award for Creative Nonfiction, the New York Times bestseller Selfish, Shallow, and Self-Absorbed, 16 Writers on the Decision Not to Have Kids, the essay collection My Misspent Youth, the novel The Quality of Life Report, and Life Would Be Perfect If I Lived in That House. In 2019, Megan became a biweekly columnist for Medium. From 2005 to 2016, she was an op-ed columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Her work has been included in the Best American Essays, and she has written for numerous magazines, including The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The New York Times Book Review, The Atlantic, and Vogue. She has a new book. It's called The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. Megan Dom, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly. It's great to be here.
So towards the end of the book, you write about the night of November 9th, the evening following the Trump presidential victory. And you decide to sit up late listening to Randy Newman's Good Old Boys, which is an absolute classic concept album. I mean, it is, for people who are into this, this is like one of the great albums of any genre. And as you write of the album, quote, "The satire is so relentlessly dry, it can leave your mouth feeling chalky at times," end quote. So I've had this conversation with my friends at Second City. Newman couldn't make that album today, or could he?
Oh, I don't think he could make it. He could make it on his own, I suppose.
And then not air it? Yeah.
You know, it's funny. No one has asked me about this yet. It is such an interesting album, and it was such a weird thing that I did, that I sat there that night and just listened to it. So I guess, just so people know, came out in 1972, I think.
Yep.
It's a tribute to the South. Now, Randy Newman has made his living as someone who scores movies, mm-hmm. and often in a very schmaltzy, sentimental way. He did, like, Toy Story, all the Pixar films, right?
Yep, natural.
But as a singer-songwriter, he is just profoundly dry, almost to the point of acidic, but, like, really profound and really honest. And so, you know, that album is an example of taking on the persona of somebody else. Mm-hmm. He is singing in the first person, but he is singing from the point of view of somebody who is a racist, somebody who is completely clueless, just all sorts of characters, mostly white characters in the South that would be considered utterly unsavory today, were considered unsavory back in 1972. But the idea of taking such a person seriously enough to craft a work of art around them, I mean, it's something that Faulkner did. There's certainly an mm-hmm. artistic tradition of this, but I don't know that we have the sensibility today as a mainstream culture to sort of take that in. And it's frustrating to watch.
Yeah, and I stumbled upon, because again, this is one of my favorite albums. The song Marie is just, to me, one of the most beautiful, about this guy who is terrible to his wife, and he can only say nice things about her when he's drunk and she's asleep.
Right.
It's beautiful. And we should also note that Newman got in trouble when he wrote the song Short People, because people thought he was actually making fun of short people.
And that was a comment on racism.
Exactly.
I mean, clearly.
Yeah.
And deliberately, intentionally, clearly to everybody but a few people.
Yeah, and I felt like in the same way that you, like when I was a young person and a girl rejected me, I'd go in my room and listen to Jackson Browne records. I feel like you were doing that, but at a cultural and personal crossroads, which is what this book is about. Your life, how you were going to write this, what the book was going to be about, what you were going on personally, what was going on in the country. And this was just that Jackson Browne in your bedroom moment.
Yeah, I guess it was. I mean, it's funny. The book really started off as being about feminism because I started it before Trump was even anybody was taking seriously as a candidate. And so, you know, the biggest kind of crisis of the time was, could we get Hillary elected, and what was going on with women, and just the whole sort of identity landscape has changed so much over that time. So it was like, I joke, it was like playing whack-a-mole, like trying to figure out which issues to take on and what to dive into and what to forget about. So it was pretty overwhelming.
So when you start writing this, though, you were writing it as a critique of modern feminism with the idea that Hillary Clinton was going to be sitting in that office.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up really alongside second wave feminism. I was born in 1970. Okay. Abortion became legal in 1973. I was 3 years old. I remember when I was 12, 1982, sitting in the kitchen with my mother when we heard on NPR that the Equal Rights Amendment was dead in the water. And we were baffled by that, and I remember my mother being really sad about it. Mm-hmm. But amid all this, I never had the sense growing up that being a girl was any sort of hindrance. If anything, I thought it was an advantage. All around me, I saw girls doing better than boys. We were doing better in school. It was cool to be a tomboy. There wasn't this sort of relentless girliness that you started to see in later decades. You know, by the time I got to college, there were more women than men in college and graduating. You know, by the time I was in my 30s, there were more single women buying real estate, for example, than single men. That is still very much the case. Mm-hmm. So, you know, fast forward a couple decades, and I'm sitting here in, you know, 2015 or so, and noticing that the premise of so much of the discussion around feminism is that we're still living under the thumb of this patriarchy, that we're still a disadvantaged class. And I thought that was really curious, considering my experience.
So I was born in 66, so a little older than you, but very much in that same era. And I recall, like, you know, I would go out to play, I'm putting up air quotes, for an entire day, and my parents couldn't track me. They didn't know where I was. It wasn't a problem. And there's been so many studies about how that's changed over time to the extent. And look, I'm bad about this. I've got a couple of kids, and my wife still, even though our son's in college, will check him where he is on her iPhone, which is just fucking invasive. This thing, and you bring up a very interesting thing around the missing children on milk cartons. So anyone our age will know about that. But that was a myth, essentially, correct?
Well, it was a myth that it was happening in such huge numbers. There were a couple of very high profile cases. Eitan Pates was the first case, the 6 year old who was abducted in Soho, walking to school. Amazing back then that responsible, loving parents let a kid that age walk to school, but they did. Mm-hmm. And it was just this absolute fluke. He was abducted and never seen again. There was the case of Adam Walsh. So, you know, we had these isolated cases. And, you know, my theory about this has always been that, you know, it's no accident that this sort of hysteria, panic, whatever you want to call it, coincided with large masses of white middle class, upper middle class women going back to work, right? You saw this happening in the 80s, and that was right around the time that the women's movement was like propelling a lot of women who had been stay-at-home moms back to the workplace. They were putting, not even back to the workplace, they were going for the first time. And so I think there might have been this sort of unconscious cultural incentive to say, well, hey, not so fast. you can't go to work because, in fact, your children are in peril if you're not at home making cookies for them. And I think that that's necessary to kind of think about in terms of framing.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, I mean, you write in the book, quote, moral panics can frequently be traced back to the discomforts of social change. And I had never conceived of that idea in the past that it might have had that effect. But indeed, you know, like it could have. And you also say, quote, I'm troubled by the ways in which contemporary feminism has turned womanhood into another kind of childhood. So that's connected, right? This sort of infantile aspect of, you know, being sort of lost and unable to protect ourselves, and it makes us very thin-skinned today.
Yeah, I mean, you see it certainly in a lot of the debates around how sexual assault cases are handled on college campuses. You know, are women, are female students to be, you know, quote unquote, infantilized or treated in such a way that that every single accusation of sexual assault, no matter how flimsy, is taken seriously to the point where there's very little due process. I mean, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want to say something about, you know, these terms like, you know, fragile and safe space and snowflake. They're coming from a very real place. There are definitely differences between, like, how our generation thinks about the world and thinks about ourselves in terms of resilience and how the, you know, millennials and generations after them do. But, you know, I really, part of the reason I wrote this book the way I did was that I wanted to get past those kind of generalizations. I wanted to get past words like trigger warning and like I said, snowflake, and really try to fine-tune what we're talking about here. I mean, are we talking about entire generations of special snowflakes, or are we talking about the way a very small segment of generations and characteristics of them have been amplified disproportionately? Are we talking about these people really being soft, or are we talking about generational differences that, if we looked at them honestly and with some self-scrutiny, could actually bridge the divide? And so I had a couple of ideas about that, and I really wanted to talk about them rather than just kind of fall back on this, oh, you know, they're so fragile and we were so tough kind of thing. As great as it feels to to say things like that.
Yeah. I remember I was up at the campus of the University of Chicago for a meeting and talking to a friend who had just walked by the doors of a theater that was playing Streetcar Named Desire, and on the door said, this performance may or may not contain a rape.
Oh, I guess it's a choose your own ending. It's a surprise.
Well, so they, like, it
no,
happens
no,
off
spoiler alert.
It happens off stage if it happens, right? I mean, but to be honest with you, like, I love telling that story because it's so funny. But I've never seen that anywhere else. And you talk about that in the book that the college campus, what's going on right now, because you teach there, is both not as bad and worse than you could ever imagine.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, there are definitely campus activists who are fragile, oversensitive, authoritarian, puritanical, whatever you want to call it. You know, yes, they're out there and they're loud and they have outsized influence, and it's putting a chokehold on a lot of discussion and debate. But, you know, to me, what's more troubling than that is the way the sort of mass culture and mainstream institutions are bending to their will. It's actually very, very few people, I think, who would really be concerned about whether or not there's a rape in Streetcar Named Desire.
Right.
But those few people have been given an incredible amount of power by social media and by this sort of ambient, celebrity-driven culture that rewards this sort of outrage and indignation, and I'm just, I feel like, you know, we're having conversations and we're reacting to things that feel very real, but they're not as real as we think, and yet we're perceiving it as reality.
Yeah, well, this would require a thing called nuance, right. Which apparently is in quite short order. We were talking before we started taping, my wife, the comedy professor, you know, has to, and she should, she has to tee up the honeymooners. You know, she's like, okay, you need to understand the context in which this was produced. And she had to make that decision of, you know, do I keep Bill Cosby in the curriculum? Do I keep Woody Allen? And she kicked out Woody Allen, kept Cosby. And I mean, so part of that is actually good. Part of that is a challenge of like, you know, good, we should sort of understand where we are now. But part of it is also going, you can't just eliminate everything that came before because you'll have no idea of how we got to where we are now.
Yeah, no, I mean, are we just going to sort of, you know, I sometimes think, well, if we cancel everybody, if cancel culture just goes on and on and on and we cancel everybody, then we'll all be canceled and we can just hit a reset, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, you know, I think the nuance is really the only word for it. I mean, part of what's going on is that we talk in tweets now and we think in memes, right? It's like mm-hmm. the president communicates in tweets, political movements and social causes are reduced to hashtags, and the public discourse really rewards this simplistic, reductive messaging and not only discourages complexity of thought, but penalizes it, right? I mean, part of the problem is that, you know, if you try to make a complicated point to be nuanced, you risk being misinterpreted and then painted as the enemy. So what's happening, and what a lot of my book is about, is that sense of cognitive dissonance and sense of internal unrest that comes from having a gap between what you feel and what you think you're supposed to feel, and being afraid to say what you think because you pretty much know you're going to be misconstrued.
Yeah. In your note about language is really important in these terms because, you know, certainly in our work in comedic improvisation and satire, we are creating a safe environment for the performers to play with very dangerous ideas. That's the idea. And so that requires holding two opposite thoughts in your brain at the same time, which I believe Fitzgerald said was the key to intelligence.
Everybody said that, by the way. That idea has been attributed to at least 35 different very wise people. So
it's a great one. And you know, and what we know about the improvisational mind is it's something, it's practice in divergent thinking. And that really requires you to play with a lot of stuff. And I thought the illustration to me that kind of blew me away in the book was when you tell the story about riding the subway home to Upper Manhattan late one night, because that takes this very, you know, singular thing and exposes like, oh, you're not seeing all the things that are at play.
Right. So that was an interesting thing. You know, I lived in New York when I was in my 20s in the 1990s. And then I was away for a long time and I came back to New York about 4 years ago. The city had changed a lot. So, you know, it used to be back then, you know, if you rode the subway late at night, you were just hoping there was anybody on there because you would be on an empty subway car. There was a lot of muggings. There was a lot of crime. There was a very different feel around things. So, yeah, this was about a year or so ago. I was riding home, it's probably around midnight, very crowded, not very crowded, but, you know, a fair amount of people on the subway. And how can I describe this? I've never told this story before, this will be my improv exercise.
I love it.
So there were two guys, young white guys, kind of artsy, you know, highly articulate, very, you know, sensitive seeming, nice young guys sitting across from me. And there was this sort of gaggle of girls a little further down in the subway car. They were probably in their early 20s, white girls probably from the suburbs. Mm-hmm. They didn't seem like they lived in the city. They were kind of drunk. It seemed like maybe they'd been at a, you know, come into the city for some kind of party or bridal shower or something. And so a guy boards the subway at one point, and he's like panhandling, and I don't know if he's homeless or, you know, probably pretty clearly mentally ill, and he tried to talk to me for a second, and I kind of waved him off, and he was African-American, black guy, And the girls were just sort of fascinated by him. And he started flirting with him, and they started flirting back, and they had him sit down. And the girls just seemed very pleased with themselves that they were having this interaction. And he was still sort of, you know, asking for a little bit of money. And then, you know, he finally decides to get off the car, and they say, oh, he says, have a wonderful night. And they say, you too. And then he stopped. He got right up in my face as he was leaving the car, and he said, you, I don't know if I can say this
go say
on
it.
The podcast.
You can.
I can't. He says, you have a fucked up night. And then he yelled, bitch, right in my face.
Wow.
And I actually laughed a little because I thought, well, you have a fucked up night. That's kind of brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the two young guys that were directly across from me said, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. You know, the guy got off the train. Mm-hmm. He was of absolutely no threat to me. He was a pretty small, wiry guy. He posed no physical threat. Totally typical thing that would have happened 20 years ago. It would have happened every time you were on the subway. And these guys were falling all over themselves, like apologizing. They were saying, oh my gosh, are you okay? I'm so sorry you had experienced that. And I was sort of like, whatever, it's, you know, whatever. And I realized at a certain point, they weren't really concerned about me. They were concerned about excusing themselves. They felt that they had to apologize on behalf of the patriarchy for the behavior of a mentally ill, probably homeless guy with absolutely no power whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing was just like this amazing constellation of notions about power and perceptions about who's in charge and what is safety and what is an authentic interaction. And it was just sort of dizzying. And that is a scene that I present in the book. And you know what's been interesting about that is I actually did a reading. I read that scene in public, and there were a lot of young people in the audience. And several young people were made very uncomfortable by it.
Yeah.
And said that they thought it was problematic, but they when I pressed them, they could not tell me why. They were like, "Well, there was something about it. It just it seems wrong."
Yeah.
But they couldn't say what it was.
Well, you write about this in the book, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but I mean the all that could be going on with that situation involve mental illness, race, class, so many lists of various issues that could be in play with what happened in that action, that to reduce it to this one idea is just intellectually dishonest.
Yeah, and it's actually lazy. I say it's boring, and it's actually just, it's not a really intelligent way to go through life. It just feels to me very rote. I think we're in a moment where people are just feeling like they have to kind of do these perfunctory apologies or I sometimes think of it as catechisms, you know, the to be sure. So I was a columnist for a long time. I was at the Los Angeles Times for more than 10 years. And, you know, when you're a newspaper columnist, there's this thing you do where, you know, before you make your argument, you sort of inoculate yourself against all the counterarguments that might be out there. So you go, you know, to be sure, there are many ways in which I could be wrong, and you might say this or this or this, but at the end of the day, I still believe this, and here's why. And I have noticed this thing in a lot of journalism where the to be sure paragraph is taking up like 2/3 of the piece.
Right, right.
And then the argument is sort of made, and then we're over and out.
Well, I'm about to do that. I talked about we have a program at the University of Chicago, and one of the professors I was talking to, because we were creating an executive education program using behavioral science and improvisation, and it was in the D&I, diversity and inclusion space. And we had been teaching about microaggressions, and he's like, actually, that's not a thing. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he sent me this like trove of literature. First of all, the language isn't right if an aggression can't be micro. And secondly, to the earlier point that the story illustrates is there are so many different ways that I could hate you, that to define it simply as this one, there's no way you could actually know that. And so you know, one, I didn't do it, but one would normally preface talking about that, and I've done this before when I've talked about it, as saying, like, I understand institutional racism. I understand the way different people undercut each other. But then there's other things. And a phrase I use a lot, you know, both things can be true, yes, is just no one wants to hear that.
But that's the only answer.
It is the only answer.
Anything that is true is complicated.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
I mean, the minute you scratch beneath the surface of anything, many things are true at the same time. I would really be curious to talk with you. I mean, the whole punch up, punch down,
yep,
logic, that comes from comedy, right?
It does.
That comes from stand-up comedy. So the idea being that you can make fun of somebody who has more power than you,
yep,
somebody who's a celebrity, somebody who's a politician, somebody who's richer than you, for instance. But it's not cool in comedy to punch down, to,
yep,
make fun of somebody who's disabled or,
right,
doesn't, you know, child, whatever. So, you know, we have the manifestation of this in this sort of social justice conversation where, you know, you can say, you know, in the realm of feminism, I talk about this a lot. So now, it's become sort of fashionable or cool or at least, you know, entirely acceptable to make fun of white men, to,
yeah,
you know, complain about mansplaining or manspreading on the subway,
yep,
or just, you know, how oppressive men can be and are keeping women down all the time. Now, sometimes that is true,
mm-hmm,
but to me, it's really logically nonsensical because the minute if you're punching up at men, if you are going to assume that anything you say about men is automatically punching up, you are assuming they have power. You
all
are
them.
Handing them power that,
yep,
they don't even necessarily have.
Yeah.
And it's...
The hashtag kill all white men, or, you know, like kill all men.
Right.
I've seen,
right,
that pop up on social media.
Yeah, and I find it completely counterproductive. I mean, we're actually, you know, women, we're taking our own power and almost handing it to them. Like, we're knocking them off of a pedestal that they're not even necessarily on. Like, are some men more powerful than some or many women? Yes, absolutely. But as it happens, I mean, like I said earlier, in the aggregate, women are doing much better than men. Our much higher educations, we're healthier, we're more involved in our communities, you know, it could go on and on. You know, yes, there are more men in quarters of power, there are more male CEOs, there are more, you know, men in Senate, yes, and that's not changing fast enough, but, you know, on the whole, men are suffering and women are soaring ahead, and so the idea that we're going to go around just sort of beating up on them in this sort of abstract way, and that this is going to be considered a form of feminism, I find that deeply unfeminist. And as a person who still calls herself a feminist, I find it troubling, if not embarrassing, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when Me Too happened, part of what was amazing was a lot of people I know who were silent about really terrible things that they had, you know, suffered at the hands of men. I thought that was a powerful expression and one that was needed. But to your point you're making, you know, having raised a daughter, you know, I don't know who has more power than a bunch of 14, 15 or 16 year old white girls. I mean, it's like they're just like dominate the school. And it's like, you know, like,
right,
there's no getting, you know, past that. And again, both things can be true. But the Me Too movement, too, and you talk about that in the book. I mean, I remember when that Google spreadsheet came out, the shitty media man list.
Yes.
I saw people on there I knew. And for some of them, I'm like, yeah, belongs on there. And other ones, I'm like, really? That person's on there?
Yeah, I mean, that was really that incident. And then the Aziz Ansari case,
right,
I think, you know, those were the two moments where the generational divides really began to be pronounced with Me Too. I mean, I don't think there's any rational thinking person that is going to say the Me Too is not a net positive. It's been incredibly important. It was long overdue. But, you know, you've got on one hand obvious, undeniable monsters like Harvey Weinstein, and then, mm-hmm, you've got cases like Aziz Ansari where you really, I mean, I don't know if we need to explain to your listeners what happened there, but, you know,
that was
a case where there was really a very striking difference between the ways a lot of younger women were interpreting that and a lot of older women were interpreting it. And, you know, it really takes me back to one of the things I talk a lot about in the book is this idea that I think, you know, the Gen Xers, you know, we grew up sort of fetishizing toughness. Like, it was really important to be resilient. It wasn't just like something that we were conditioned to be. We were proud of it. Like, mm-hmm. I almost feel like there was something like, it was very cool to like break your arm and then come to school in a cast.
Yeah.
And, you know, I noticed that the millennials and the, you know, Gen Zers, they feel similarly about fairness. Mm-hmm. Like, it's almost like they fetishize fairness the way we perhaps overvalued toughness. And I think some of those Me Too cases illustrate that pretty clearly. You know, you had a lot of older second wave feminists, Gen Xers, saying, well, that was just a bad date. That what happened yeah. with Aziz Ansari there was a bad date. And you had a lot of younger women saying, no, like, that's, we need to
assault.
Stop calling these things bad dates.
Yeah.
And I don't really, at this point, I kind of feel like it's not for me to decide. I kind of am starting to feel like these generations need to work it out for themselves, because I think they grew up with a lot of things that we didn't have to deal with, whether it be internet pornography, dating apps. I think they approach social and sexual negotiations,
yeah,
differently than we do. And I've come around to thinking it's important to recognize that.
Yeah, that's fair. One thing we haven't mentioned, and I think it's very important to the book, is that, you know, you experienced this loss at this age. You're going through a divorce, and that's really central to a lot of sort of exploring, you know, there's this outward stuff going on, but there's this inward conflict that you were experiencing, and a kind of a tragedy, a kind of a trauma, I think.
Yeah, you know, we ask, you know, sometimes people ask, well, what is the problem with everything, you know? And so, a lot of what I talk about in the book is how, you know, I was married and I had a very amicable divorce, but a divorce nonetheless. And, you know, my husband, for all our problems, was really my intellectual ally. You know, when it came to our observations about the world and what makes us feel alienated from it, what was the problem with everything, we could have talked forever, you know. And so when we split up, I lost my conversation partner in a lot of ways. And it happened to be coinciding with this time where conversation was being stilted in the public discourse. You know, suddenly nuance was not just out of style, but not allowed. And so there was almost like this double whammy. Like, I wasn't having these sort of complicated discussions with my husband, and I wasn't able to, like, even witness them on social media. I wasn't, you know, there were even, you know, in some cases, friends of mine, acquaintances of mine, who were starting to be wary of certain topics. And so, yeah, that sort of loss was really a huge driver of the book.
Yeah, and as a writer, you lost all your words, you know, that's everything. And the end of the book is really beautiful. I mean, your writing is very beautiful. And at the end of the book, you write that the problem with everything, quote, it's meant to invite our smartest selves to join hands with our stupidest selves and see where the other leads us. I love that. I feel like that speaks to the sort of folly of the human experience in an incredibly beautiful way.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks. I mean, I think the problem with everything is that people can't be alone.
Mm.
Like, they can't be alone with their thoughts. And, you know, I say in the book, like, the more honest you are with your thoughts, the more you're alone with your thoughts. And, you know, social media, you know, makes it so the reward system for not being alone with your thoughts, for having the same opinion as everyone else, is almost irresistible. So there's social currency in thinking the same thing everyone else thinks. And to me, that's not what's fun about thinking.
No.
Think about new things.
Right. And you know, we talk about this in our work all the time, which is, you know, at Second City, we improvise in front of audiences to get to the content for the show. And the reason we do that is that we have to work out all the dumb stuff, the potentially offensive stuff, the stuff that actually is offensive, and then we bring it back. There's a director, Mick Napier, who does this thing called Taboo Day. You know, everyone has complete, we tell everyone they have complete freedom at Second City to do whatever they want, but he even recognized you're probably holding yourself back. So he does Taboo Day, which is you have to bring in an idea that is so offensive, Second City would never allow it to be on the stage. And invariably, that's the material that goes on the stage.
Oh, I love it. Taboo Day.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean,
it's a federal holiday.
It should be a federal holiday. All right. Every guest that we have on the podcast, we asked to tell a yes and story. So it's a time in your life when you normally would have said no, but instead you yes and. You affirm and contribute in the parlance of improvisation to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a story for us.
Oh, you know, I may have touched on this before. I mean, it's really, I thought about this a lot, and it's funny. I don't have any, like, super firsthand stories because my ex-husband will tell you I'm, like, the least adventurous person in the world. I never want to do anything.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, like I said, you know, I talk a lot in the book about how my generation placed this huge value on toughness, and the younger ones really think a lot about fairness. And for a long time, I operated on the assumption that my way was better. Like, the toughness was serving us better. And that they were not really living in the world the right way because they were, quote unquote, fragile. So not that anyone's against fairness, of course, but mm-hmm. I operated on the assumption that there was this sort of naive expectation about fairness, like an unwillingness to deal with the realities of any kind of social hierarchy or power structure or whatever, because you were so hung up on these kind of naive ideas about fairness. But then after a while, I started coming around to the idea that, like you said earlier, maybe we're both right. Like, mm-hmm. maybe there's value in both approaches. So I guess my story would be if someone said to me, you know, if you had said to me, well, millennials have it right and the older folks are out of step, whereas I once would have said, no, your view is naive, I think I've gotten to a point where I say, yes, and mm-hmm. here's how we might meet in the middle. Here is how I can teach you to be a little tougher, and maybe you can teach me how to think differently about fairness.
And I don't think you would have got there, honestly, without the divorce, without the that being in the most uncomfortable of places where it forces you completely outside of yourself. And I just experienced that in my life. Is I don't make these major, and this is the point of the book too, you don't make these discoveries without pain. If it's working, if you go to work out and it's working, it hurts. And that seems to be true in my experiences. I've gotten older with everything that's worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, discomfort is underrated.
Yeah. Okay, that's going to be our hashtag. The book is called The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. Megan Dom, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
Getting the S.A.N. is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbleberry, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survives. Survive.